Call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today is May 6th. We're in Senate Finance Committee, the State Capitol. President Chairman Stedman, expects Chairman Olson shortly, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk, and myself, Senator Hoffman. We have three items on today's agenda. The first item is Senate Bill 184, School Bond and Debt, Bond Debt Reimbursement. Senate Bill 92, Corporate Income Tax, Oil and Gas Entities. And finally, Senate Bill 156, Alaska Commercial Fishing and Agricultural Bank Loans. The first item, Senate Bill 184, School Bond Debt Reimbursement. This is the first hearing on this bill. We'll invite Liz Harpole of Senator Olson's office to the Senate Finance table to introduce the bill for the record and give us a presentation on what the bill actually does. Ms. Harpole.
Thank you. Good morning. For the record, Liz Harpold, staff to Senator Olson and the Senate Finance Committee. To provide a little history on this moratorium, I've pulled some info from the last time this was extended in 2020. Back in 2015, the legislature passed a law placing a moratorium on school bond debt reimbursement. This was in an effort to combat the increasingly volatile fiscal situation the state found itself in. Prior to this, municipalities could bond for school construction or major maintenance projects and get a percentage reimbursed by the state. The percentage reimbursed depends on the type of project and the date the bond was approved by voters. Projects approved before 2015 were not affected by the moratorium, and the state continued to make payments on existing debt. Since then, all bonds approved by voters are not eligible for reimbursement by the state, and all costs are assumed by the local municipalities. This moratorium, when it originally went into effect back in 2015, was set to expire in 2020, but the legislature passed a bill extending that date to 2025. Here we are now. Senate Bill 184 extends this moratorium by 2 years to July 1st, 2027.
Thank you for that explanation. Do members of the Finance Committee have questions on what the bill does? Seeing none, we will open the public testimony at this time. And is there anyone online? Is there anyone in the audience that wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll close public hearing. Senator Keel, Fiskin, Senator Stedman.
Just under comments when you're ready, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 184 has one fiscal note from the Department of Education Early Development. It's under debt service for the school debt reimbursement allocation, which is component 153. And it reflects the funding that is in the governor's request for the current year. It has an indeterminate cost beyond FY 28 and beyond when the new moratorium expires, but it does not incur new operating or capital costs as a result of the bill.
Do members have questions on the fiscal note? Seeing none, Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to note for the communities that are possibly looking at this extension not going forward, that in the proposed budget as we have today, there's a reduction in the school bond debt reimbursement, and there was discussions in that process on the amount of the reduction all the way from no haircut to 25, 50, 75, and then no reimbursement. There is a slight reduction this year, I think, proposed in one of the budgets, and we'll see how the conference committee puts the final budget together. But with that being said, I would just like to remind the communities that these debt reimbursements are subject to appropriation, and the headwinds coming at the state financially are getting more substantial almost by the week, it seems like, clearly by month. So I would highly caution the communities not to expect even if this moratorium does not pass and they issue school bond debts and expect a reimbursement from the legislature the next few years, it may not materialize. In fact, it's highly likely it won't. So I just thought I'd put that on the record, Mr. Chairman, so those that are possibly waiting to issue school bond debt to deal with their needed school issues, and we would agree that they're definitely needed. But at the end of the day, as you've said many times here, Mr. Chairman, we can't spend money we don't have.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll piggyback on Senator Stedman's comments, but from a different angle. We've heard presentation after presentation at this table about just how massive the deferred maintenance needs of our schools are. And there isn't any question in the constitutional language. It is the legislature's obligation not just to operate but to maintain a system of public education. And the courts have answered the question whether that includes the buildings. I think it's perfectly fair and appropriate to ask municipalities with a tax base to contribute, to split it with them in some proportion. We've used different proportions over the years. But the simple fact is, for years now, the state has underspent dramatically on our constitutional obligation. This is one of our biggest deferred maintenance pots. And if we don't get our financial house in order and continue to underspend the way we have been on this, we're going to face not only a lawsuit that the state's likely to lose, we're going to have kids in terrible situations where they don't have the ability to learn because they're cold or their feet go through the floor. So I appreciate that this bill has come down from the past five-year moratoriums. This is a two-year moratorium. And as Senator Stedman said, the next 2 years, the money isn't there. We've got to bring the money there. In one way or another, there are different philosophies, but if we don't raise some revenue, probably and reallocate some spending, we're in a lot of trouble. So, Mr. Chairman, the necessity of the immediate moment is in front of us, but we have got to raise some revenue and start again at some point soon to repair schools. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel. I would concur not only as it relates to schools, but all other services. We have had difficulty this year in balancing this year's budget. There are more needs than there are funds, and every single member of this Finance Committee is well aware of that. With that, we'll set this bill aside and go to item two, which is the Senate Bill 92, Corporate Income Tax, Oil and Gas Entities. This is the fourth hearing on this bill. We've taken public testimony, adopted a cleanup CS, and reviewed the fiscal notes. So I invite Senator Kathy Geisel to the table to reintroduce the bill to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Kathy Geisel, State Senator for District E in Anchorage. Mr. Chairman, just a brief overview of this bill. It would incorporate a tax on an S corporation. This is a pass-through entity. This committee's already reviewed the meaning of that word. The tax would be imposed at a profit of $5 million or more, and the tax rate would be 9.4% of taxable income would be the revenue. Mr. Chairman, this would actually result in the same amount of revenue that would be generated from the C corporation tax. We had the numbers run by a CPA, a certified public accountant, with a scenario of a company that made $1 billion in taxable income. The two resulting taxation structure would impose a $93 million tax on a C corporation, and the same number, a few hundred million less, on an S corporation. Mr. Chairman, this corrects an oversight in our tax structure that was made in 1979 when Alaska eliminated their personal income tax, thereby not taxing S corporations regardless of their income or industry, and again in 2014 when S corporations began to come here, large entities, and begin to develop our oil and gas resources. This tax would be imposed on companies doing work in the oil and gas industry. Mr. Chairman, it's often been said that this tax is targeting a single company, and yet in testimony before Senate Resources, the Alaska Oil and Gas Association CEO indicated that it affected more than one of her members. So it is broad, Mr. Chairman, and as I said, it's very equitable. The CPA ran the numbers. You will also hear that this will restrict the investments being made by these S corporations. Mr. Chairman, they're working in the same fields as our C corporations, Cook Inlet, North Slope. They're also expanding to what we call Middle Earth. That's around the interior in Fairbanks. Mr. Chairman, they are productively working, profitably working in the same venues that our C corporations are. This would impose the same corporate structure tax on both entities. That's a summary. Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you. Senator, can it also be said, and is being said, that of the majors, this levels the playing field?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You are correct. This levels the playing field.
Thank you. Are there further questions of the senator? Seeing none, we will go to invited testimony. We have the senior vice president from Hillcorp here today. So will Luke Sojay come to the table and introduce yourself and give us your invited testimony?
Good morning, co-chairs, Hoffman, Olson, and Stedman, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be able to testify today. For the record, my name is Luke Sojay. I serve as the senior vice president for Hillcorp Alaska, and I'm proud to be here today representing the roughly 1,700 Hillcorp Alaska employees. I'm here to provide an update on Hillcorp's business operations and how various measures before the Alaska legislature, including Senate Bill 92, could impact the vital stability we rely on to invest and increase production in the Cook Inlet and Alaska's North Slope. So thank you again for inviting me to be here and for welcoming me back to this committee. So we have the slides there on the screen overhead, so we can roll through these. And as the committee knows, if you go to the next slide, please. Or do I have? Oh, hey, all right. As this committee knows, Hillcorp came to Alaska in 2012. At that time, the Rail Belt was facing a natural gas shortage, preparing for the possibility of brownouts. And as major companies such as Conoco, Marathon, and Chevron exited the inlet, Hillcorp acquired their old fields and immediately invested to stabilize natural gas supply for the Rail Belt. Since 2012, Hillcorp has invested over $1.4 billion in Cook Inlet on new projects and produced more than 750 billion cubic feet of natural gas in the Cook Inlet to keep the lights on. We've drilled roughly 120 new wells, completed over 400 well repair projects, and introduced innovative technologies such as new drilling rigs, new on- and offshore pulling units, 3D seismic, and some interesting new petrophysical evaluation techniques. We're proud of the role that we play in delivering Cook Inlet natural gas to Rail Belt homes, families, and businesses, including our own homes, families, and businesses, since we are all based in the Anchorage and Kenai area, including working with other Cook Inlet operators through the use of our Spartan 151 jackup rig to develop new wells and bring new gas resources to market. And, you know, to my knowledge, there are no C Corps working in the Cook Inlet. So just as Hilcorp has grown, so has our commitment to Alaska. In 2014, we entered the North Slope.
So, Jay, are you on slide 2 or on 3?
On slide 2.
Okay. Please proceed.
Yeah, we entered the North Slope with the acquisition of Endicott North Star and a 50% ownership of the Milne Point field. And at that point in time, BP kept the other 50%. And just like in Cook Inlet, Hilcorp made substantial investments and introduced new technologies to the North Slope, particularly polymer flooding and horizontal drilling at Milne Point. And just like in Cook Inlet, production increased as we invested. Since taking over as operator in 2015, Hilcorp has invested well over $1 billion at Milne Point. We've drilled more than 161 new wells, which is about 430 miles of lateral drilling. And we've produced more than 110 million barrels of oil over that time. As a direct result of our investment and our commitment to revitalize Milne Point during our 10 years of ownership, we're proud to say that we've grown production from approximately 18,000 barrels a day in 2014 when we took over to more than 51,000 barrels today. With continued investment, we expect to see production top 60,000 barrels a day in the next 3 or 4 years. 2 years ago, before this same committee, I said that we planned to build a new drill site called the Raven Pad, and today I'm proud to report that we brought the Raven Pad online last year. This represents about a $700 million development for Hilcorp, and that's already producing several thousand barrels a day, and we believe we can grow that production from that pad to over 10,000 barrels per day in the years to come. We've continued to invest and grow production just like we said we would. And in fact, we expect Milne Point production to surpass the all-time high achieved under the prior operator in the next few years. Ultimately, it's our goal to expand production for the benefit of all Alaskans, which results in increased revenue in the form of additional royalty payments, production taxes, net profit sharing, and property tax payments. And this, of course, requires stability and certainty as we make long-term strategic decisions on how to allocate our resources. In 2014, despite there previously being legislative concepts introduced to institute an income tax on all independent and small businesses in Alaska, there were virtually no discussions about Hilcorp's business structure. People were simply excited about the hundreds of millions of dollars that we were investing in Alaska and the progress we were making to increase production. In fact, I think Hilcorp was met generally with gratitude and appreciation for those who understood the positive impact our ownership would have on Alaska as large multinational legacy companies left the state. I think people shared our optimism and understood that we were entering into, you know, kind of a partnership with the state because of the valuable role that independent oil and gas companies like Hilcorp play in managing aging assets. In 2020, Hilcorp made its largest Alaska investment to date with the acquisition of BP's remaining Alaska assets, including acquiring their 27% stake in Prudhoe Bay Field and becoming the operator. And I think it's important to clarify, Hilcorp is the largest operator on the North Slope, but we only own 27% of Prudhoe Bay. Conoco owns, you know, about 35%, and Exxon owns about 35%. We operate on their behalf, so we make decisions about how and where and when to invest the money. But when companies report production numbers, the production numbers they report are their take from Prudhoe Bay, as well as all of the other fields where they have an ownership. So while we are the operator of Prudhoe Bay, we do not receive all of the oil from Prudhoe Bay. In the years leading up to 2020, it was notable that the operator of Prudhoe had been reducing their investment for quite some time. Their investments and their production at Prudhoe Bay were on a steady decline. BP was not drilling new wells and had not done so for a number of years, and of course that's why production was falling off. And you can see on that graph, that's, you know, that's actual data showing production for Prudhoe Bay. This came at a time when BP had publicly announced their intention to divest major portions of their oil and gas portfolio and to pursue a renewable energy portfolio, and simply put, Alaska was on their chopping block. They didn't want anything to do with it. At the same time, many other outside forces were discouraging investment in Alaska, and you probably remember financial institutions were redlining investments in Alaska and in the Arctic. There were numerous pressure campaigns from corporate stakeholders and those with an anti-resource development agenda calling for the divestiture of Alaskan oil and gas. As a privately owned company, Hilcorp is independent, but we are subject to those same market pressures. I can tell you we lost two-thirds of the banks in our bank group because we operated assets in Alaska. They were very clear about why they didn't want to do business with us anymore. And as a private company, that credit facility, that bank credit facility, is tremendously important to us because we do not have access to public capital markets in the same way that large C corporations do. But we have consistently pushed back on the anti-Alaska, anti-development narrative, and we've committed to being a good partner and operator on the North Slope, bringing our years of experience in maximizing production from late-life fields that many others had given up on. You know, it's worth noting, at BP's departure, many in Alaska and in the legislature were concerned about Alaska's future and competitiveness. The Senate president at the time, Senator Giesel, noted that they were worried disputes over oil and gas taxation may have encouraged BP's departure. The quote that I had was, quote, "I am excited to see Hilcorp expand its investment in Alaska. At the same time, BP's exit raises significant concerns and questions in my mind about the impact of Alaska's political instability on BP's business decision." Political instability and fiscal instability is a huge problem for us. Since becoming operator of Prudhoe, we have worked closely with our partners Conoco and Exxon to increase investments in this great legacy field. We're drilling new wells, we're fixing old wells, repairing and expanding the oil processing facilities. And just like in Cook Inlet, we have effectively stopped production decline at Prudhoe Bay, as that graph shows. And this is a major reversal from the prior two decades of decline, and a big difference from the 4% annual decline projected by DNR in 2019. I'm very proud of our team in Alaska and the hard work they've put in to make all of this happen. The work Hilcorp has done at various fields across Alaska to grow production and reserves has resulted in significantly more oil in the pipeline, more natural gas for Alaskan homes and businesses, and billions of dollars of additional revenue to the state of Alaska in the form of royalties, production taxes, property taxes, and net profit share payments. We've increased our investments every year for the last 3 years, and in 2025, just as was the case in 23 and 24, we've approved our largest ever budget for the state of Alaska, and I'm proud to say that today Alaska makes up about 70% of our company overall.
Senator Merrick has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for being here, Mr. Soje. In Senate Resources, you stated it costs about 10 times more to do business in Alaska than it does in Texas. If it's so difficult and expensive to operate here in Alaska, why do you continue to invest here?
Mr. Soje.
Through the chair, Alaska's been good for us. We've been able to grow. And I think that's one of the most important things. You know, our company is focused on growth, and we have the ability to grow organically in Alaska, right? There's a resource there to be developed, as we showed on the previous slide for Milne Point, is we're able to drill wells consistently. And I think, you know, that speaks to the importance of stability and predictability. When we drill in Alaska, in general, we know what we're going to get. And that's very appealing to an oil and gas company because it is a difficult and volatile business. And so we like to channel our investments where there is predictability. And the results of our drilling program has been very predictable here.
Senator Merrick.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Merrick. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was a comment you made just maybe a third of the way into this slide, referencing the loss of some lending institutions to the company. And there's been, since then, there's been a dramatic shift in the policies in Washington. And I'm wondering what kind of feedback you're getting currently from the lending institutions, because we've had those discussions here at the table, talking about, as a counter, redirecting some of our financial assets, the state's financial assets, away from those institutions that would not assist Alaska businesses moving forward with the oil and gas development.
Through the chair, you know, Senator, we saw, as I said, that about two-thirds of the banks in our bank group dropped us and declined to participate in providing credit to us going forward. You know, they've begun to trickle back in. As you said, there's been a little bit of a sea change in Washington. But it's, you know, I would say one or two of them have come back. One thing I can say is we've been able to do a little bit of business with some of the local Alaskan banks. And so that's, you know, something that we appreciate. They've been able to step in. But in aggregate, I think we're still dramatically fewer banks than we had, call it, you know, 7 years ago.
Senator Stedman. Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question I maybe should have asked on an earlier slide. Mr. Soje, you talked about the shares of ownership. You used, I think, Prudhoe as an example. Is that how the oil out is split right on those shares of ownership? And I guess the same question for the costs.
Through the chair, yes, sir, that's correct. So for every barrel of oil you receive your proportionate share, the state receives about 12.5%, Hillcorp receives 23%, et cetera. Conoco receives more, Exxon receives more.
Senator Keel.
And the state obviously doesn't put in the costs.
That's correct. The state does not contribute costs. The owners contribute their proportionate share of the costs.
Sure. Thank you.
The state contributes oil, our oil. Mr. Soje.
So, as a result of our work on the North Slope, the state of Alaska has reported significant increases to production at Prudhoe Bay and Milne Point. We are currently operating, I want to make sure I get my number right here. We're currently operating 7 rigs on the North Slope, and that's a goal I outlined to this committee 2 years ago. Next year, we're going to add another rig at Point Thompson Field and another rig at the Nikaichuk Field. These major capital investments will play a critical role in keeping Alaskans employed, putting more oil in the pipeline, and generating revenue for North Slope communities in the state of Alaska. The data on this slide comes from the Department of Revenue forecast from the fall of 2019. And going back to that point in time, fall of 2019, you can see that production at Prudhoe Bay and the satellite fields had been declining for the last 10 years, as shown on the graph. And the expectation at that time was that production would continue to decline for the foreseeable future. So the green line, the green solid line, represents the actual production from Hillcorp-operated fields, Prudhoe Bay and the satellites. The dashed black line reflects the Department of Revenue forecast from 2019. That's obviously a very big difference from the expectations under the prior operator that was made in 2019. Over the 10-year period of the forecast, from 2019 through 2029, that wedge is worth about 230 million barrels of oil of additional production to the state. Every year that goes by, that wedge gets bigger and bigger. So, for example, in 2023, the expected difference between the 2019 forecast and the 2023 forecast is over 24 million barrels in a single year, and it's expected to get to about 30 million barrels difference in 2025, and that's a result of our continued and aggressive investment in these great assets. And today, as a result of billions of dollars in new investments and the development of new technology and a renewed commitment to developing Alaska's energy resources, I'm proud to testify that, again, as a direct result of Hilcorp activity, production is so much higher that the state of Alaska has benefited from higher revenue than had the previous operator, BP, remained in place with its tax structure. That's an important point. The state of Alaska has received more revenue from the benefit of Hilcorp's investment and stewardship of these assets on behalf of the state than had the prior operator remained in place, continued decline, continued a lack of investment, but paid whatever corporate tax BP was paying. Compared to the fall 2019 forecast from 21 to 24, the Hilcorp wedge accounts for an incremental increase of 77 million barrels, and the value of this increased production is approximately $1.3 billion. Looking forward, if we're able to continue our steady investments, the impact of the Hilcorp wedge over the next 5 years is an incremental increase of 167 million barrels of oil. Okay, that's about $1.8 billion in revenue for the state of Alaska. It is a false narrative to say that the state has lost revenue as a consequence of Hilcorp taking over BP's assets. The state of Alaska has gained billions of dollars in additional revenue as a direct consequence of our investments to increase production. Since coming to Alaska, Hilcorp has generated over $5.6 billion in the form of royalty payments, production taxes, property taxes, and the like. And Hilcorp contributes over $1 billion in similar government payments on an average annual basis. So we've talked a little bit about stability and certainty already. For any oil company, certainty and stability are essential for making long-term investments, creating new jobs, reinvesting in our fields, developing new wells, increasing production, and ultimately generating increased royalty and production revenues for the state. Unfortunately, Senate Bill 92 undermines the stability that has led Hilcorp to make tremendous advances on the North Slope. This bill fails to recognize the unique structure and operations of independent oil and gas producers. If enacted, Senate Bill 92 will threaten major portions of Alaska's oil and gas industry by substantially raising oil and gas taxes. This legislation specifically targets Hilcorp and other independently owned oil and gas companies. It tilts the field against the smaller independent companies like Hilcorp that Alaska's been trying for decades to incentivize to come to the state. You know, we've looked for partners for exploration opportunities in the state of Alaska, and I can tell you that it's common to hear companies that we're talking to about partnering in Alaska express their concerns about the stability of the tax policy in the state. If Senate Bill 92 is enacted, Hilcorp would be forced to scale back our investments in Alaska, including in the Cook Inlet, where the investment and operating environment is most challenged. As the operator, Prudhoe Bay, this legislation would impact overall investment in Alaska's largest oil field and impact production levels not just for Hilcorp, but also for our working interest owners, Conoco and Exxon. Again, keep in mind, a large part of Conoco oil revenue comes from Hilcorp operations at Prudhoe Bay, and the same is true for Exxon. Okay. And as many have pointed out, despite hearing about this legislation for a number of years, Senate Bill 92 and similar legislation have not been modeled or analyzed by independent experts in any meaningful way. Okay. In fact, the Department of Revenue states in their fiscal note that their assessment is, quote, highly uncertain, as the department does not have detailed information for the companies that would be impacted and that compliance would require significant changes to existing regulations to implement the changes envisioned. This bill fails to acknowledge that the world has changed when it comes to how difficult it is for fossil fuel projects to be financed and approved, including access to capital for Arctic investments. The bill disincentivizes companies from investing in Alaska and creates a chilling effect on new development. And this bill fails to properly account for the complexities of oil and gas accounting, and specifically how C corporations deduct expenses such as depletion of reserves, intangible drilling costs, and things like that from their tax revenue as compared to S corporations, which do not. So I'm an engineer. We've probably reached the limit of my knowledge about tax. But our team believes, our tax professionals have told me, that this legislation in all of its various forms contains significant discrepancies that fail to address a number of critical tax-related issues. In fact, as written today, I am told the bill does not speak clearly to how a pass-through entity like Hillcorp would be taxed, as pass-throughs such as S-corps and partnerships do not have a defined federal taxable income. Moreover, despite efforts to clean up uncertainty around qualified deductions like reserve depletion and intangible drilling costs, there are provisions of this bill that state the taxpayer may not apply as a deduction against tax liability a credit or deduction allowed under the Title 26 of the Internal Revenue Code. So this language further complicates what deductions are available for a business like Hillcorp, and even with the subcommittee substitute, the provision remains in the underlying legislation and creates significant confusion on the language's intent and how this legislation's tax provisions would be applied. So we acknowledge that the committee has attempted to address some of these very serious issues we've raised in terms of parity under the law. However, the underlying bill is, you know, we believe, poorly written, and it is incredibly difficult to fully understand the impacts to Hillcorp's business and similar entities without a more thorough look at all existing statutes. And I think, you know, by simply attempting to kind of do a blanket application of a corporate tax structure over independent oil and gas companies with, you know, a completely different structure organized as S-corps or partnership, this legislation ignores the complexities of the federal tax code within which Alaska's tax code is intimately intertwined. Senate Bill 92 ignores the unique structure and operations of independent oil and gas producers. At a time when Hillcorp is working hard to sustain development in Cook Inlet, Senate Bill 92 targets Cook Inlet natural gas producers, including but not limited to Hillcorp. Again, you know, there are no C Corps active in the Cook Inlet that I'm aware of. The proposed bill would negatively impact Cook Inlet producers at a time when new and more investment is needed to bring natural gas to the market. Small and nimble LLCs and S-corps are the future of Cook Inlet investment and even the North Slope, and Senate Bill 92 will drive this much-needed investment elsewhere. There's been some discussion about how Senate Bill 92 would level the playing field. This bill will not level the playing field. In fact, it will tilt the field against the small independent companies that the state has been trying for decades to incentivize to come to Alaska. A significant majority of Alaskan businesses are structured as LLCs or S-corps, and to single out Hillcorp and treat us differently than the more than 55,000 other LLCs and S-corporations in Alaska is, you know, seems deeply unfair. The state of Alaska, under three different governors, was fully aware of our structure when it approved each one of our transactions over the last 13 years. However, now, after Hillcorp has invested billions of dollars and dramatically increased production on the slope and in the Cook Inlet, we're being unfairly targeted. Senate Bill 92 will mean less capital to invest in long-term production-adding projects to fill the pipeline and generate royalties and production taxes. Hillcorp is a critical pillar for, sorry, Alaska is a critical pillar for our Hillcorp strategy. And as I said before, we love the stability of the results that we can deliver from Alaska. And we're committed to investing the necessary capital to deliver increased production, new jobs, and a long future in the state. But it's hard to commit long-term dollars when there's continuous uncertainty in the fiscal regime, and the state threatens to change the rules after we've invested billions of dollars. As a company, all we can do is respond, which unfortunately would mean shifting capital investment outside of Alaska. As we've done since our arrival, as an independent producer known for revitalizing aging and ignored assets, we aspire to continue to be strong partners for the state of Alaska. Through reinvestment, growth, and introduction of new technologies, We've worked hard to grow production, which has in turn resulted in increased revenues to the state for the last many years. Our goal is to continue the trend lines published by the Department of Revenue and be the partner Alaska has asked for, contributing new revenue, new high-paying jobs, increased economic activity, and new growth. With over 1,700 employees, hundreds of millions of dollars in direct wages and benefits, and more than $1 billion in direct spending with Alaska vendors, millions in annual grant distributions to Alaska nonprofits, and planned billions of dollars of investment over the next 5 years, we are optimistic about our future in the state. We just wrapped up our first quarter, and I can tell you that once again, the fields that we operate on the North Slope are making 5% more oil production than they made last year. Right, so we are doing what we said we would do. We are investing, we have a high activity level, and we are growing production, and the state benefits from that. So we're excited about our future in Alaska. We are proud of the work we've done over the last 13 years. We look forward to continuing to be an important part of the Alaskan community and economy for many years to come. So thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you for your presentation, Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering on slide 7, Mr. Chairman, if we could get an explanation on the production tax. It's showing $560 million and then $600 million, but is that at the minimum production tax, or is it some elevated amount as it escalates up, or help me with that?
So
that's OJ.
Through the chair. Senator, I believe that that tax represents the amount of tax the state would receive, well, an estimate of the amount of tax the state would receive probably at plan pricing. We use about $60 per barrel for plan pricing, and so it's, I don't think it's a minimum tax. I think it's where the state's revenues would be at that, on that sliding scale.
Okay. If you want to
statement.
If that answers after further looking at it, it needs to be altered, you could respond back to the committee, because I'm just kind of curious what that rate is. And if you use $60, that's fine. But it just, you know, we've got challenges with the production tax as far as clarity. We have to use the aggregated annual production from all the fields. So we get, you know, it's difficult for us to hit the mark. We can be high for one company, low for another, and right on for the third all at the same time. So it would be helpful if that, for a further explanation of where that production tax percentage is.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Soje, it sounds like Hillcorp now has some specifics on how the amendment and the committee substitute is perceived to fall short. I know my office, we wrote part of that amendment and asked Hillcorp for any specifics. So look forward to hearing what those are. I had a question, though, about the notion that the bill, as it's intended to operate, tilts the playing field. Did Hillcorp's entry into ownership of Prudhoe Bay tilt the playing field against the other two owners?
Mrs. Oche.
Through the chair, you know, major international C corporations are really very different animals than privately owned independent oil and gas producers. They're structured differently. They have dramatically different access to capital than independent companies do. And so, you know, they're quite different, right? And so it doesn't make sense to treat them in the same way. So to answer your question directly, no, I guess I wouldn't say it did.
Senators. Keel.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, because when you look at it, the value out of the field, there was a split proportional to ownership, and everybody paid the same tax, and then a different type of company came in. And when you look at the profit out, now more of it goes to one company than the others. and the proportion has shifted even though the ownership proportion hasn't shifted. So if that doesn't tilt the playing field, it's difficult for me to see how applying the same tax in the same way somehow does tilt the playing field. It sounds to me like we get, from a tax perspective, to equity.
Through the chair, you know, and I think that's some of the misconception about this issue entirely is, for example, our partners are large multinational corporations, and so their ability to apportion pieces of their global costs, for example, to their Alaska business is dramatically different than ours, right? So we don't have that ability to apportion like that. And so it is, you cannot directly say that we're all going to, you know, pay the same taxes and take the same amount of money. It simply doesn't work that way. We don't have a huge amount of insight, and I think this gets to Senator Stedman's question. We don't have a huge amount of insight into the amount of tax that these other companies are paying because of the deductions associated with their activities and their investments statewide and really globally, right? All of that is, I believe, taken into account when they're calculating the amount of tax that they owe.
Senator Keel.
Just to clarify, are you suggesting that the bill as written wouldn't let Hillcorp deduct any portion of its costs outside Alaska?
With respect, Senator, that's beyond my understanding. I don't know. We'd have to follow up with you on that.
Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, just that I think the bill as prepared lets anybody use the same methodology. And so if Hillcorp has operations, and I'm not familiar, in Texas or North Dakota, or a corporate office somewhere outside Alaska, they are eligible to do the same tax magic that a BP was or a ConocoPhillips is for their non-Alaska costs and assets.
Senator Cronk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if I missed it here, but what's the total number of barrels of oil produced per day by Hillcorp in Alaska?
Hillcorp produces I can give you the amount of oil that we keep. We keep about 135,000 barrels of oil per day. We operate significantly more than that. The state keeps a big chunk of it, as do our partners. But Hillcorp keeps about 135,000 barrels a day.
Thank you.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, Mr. Sauger. You were referring to tax regime stability. And I was employed by BP during that time period, and I can assure the committee and folks at home that that was one of the considerations. There was a lot of discussion amongst the upper management about the sense of instability in our tax structure, and that things could change, and that was very difficult for planning. So there is a disincentive that's caused by even the hint that a change may be pending. So I just want to mention that first. There's a disincentive, one, the instability piece, but then the other is the net tax that you end up paying. There's folks in the building that are trying to put taxes forth to disincentivize activity. We don't want people smoking. We raise the tax. And so I don't expect that you have any insights into the logic that taxes that are used to disincentivize activity can somehow be neutral in a different industry. But on the kind of the net value argument, that's really what I think is interesting. Your presentation is very strong on the number of barrels, but I don't know if it was clear enough about the net dollars. I mean, the folks in the Capitol, they like oil production, but what they really care about is revenue production. And could you just go back over that piece about of what you produce, the share that's actually under your tax method, and then all of the other net value that's gained from where the oil is going to with your partners? Thank you.
So, Jay, briefly.
Through the chair, we can certainly do that. So you can look at the slide that's on the screen. And as I said, from 2019 until today, the value to the state of having Hilcorp operate and invest in these North Slope assets over which we have control has been 77 million barrels, and that roughly translates to $1.3 billion of additional revenue to the state from all sources. Looking forward into the future, over the life of this forecast through 2029, the state can expect to benefit to the tune of 167 million barrels, which is worth about $1.8 billion of additional revenue than had the prior operator stayed in control of these assets. So, you know, the benefit to the state is 1.3 plus 1.8 is $3.1 billion over, you know, the first 10 years of Hilcorp's stewardship of these assets. I think that answers your question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the last question is to sort of pull perspective out to the whole of the slope rather than the Prudhoe Bay field, as important as it is, and it certainly is. We currently see, two major new fields being explored for and brought online. One, I think, by a Type C corporation subject to the tax at question and has production, and one by, I think, a Type C corp subject to the tax in question that doesn't have production. How ought we understand the wedge from their investments relative to this wedge, and what's the role of the tax in question?
Mr. Sojay.
Through the chair, I'll try to answer your question. In daily production, the value of having Hilcorp operate is about, we've brought on a new 80,000 barrels per day. I'm not aware how much additional oil production these other investments have brought on. Does that answer your question? I don't think it's any yet.
Senator Keel.
But, Mr. Chairman, that's I don't believe it is any yet, but I notice there's a future five-year incremental impact on the slide, and there may be some future impact from Willow and Pica. Excuse me. How should we understand the role of the state's corporate income tax on oil and gas producers?
With respect, I really can't speak to how those other companies are taxed or what that looks like as far as their investments. I'm really not sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think there's a pretty big wedge coming from them, and they are subject to the same tax we're discussing here.
Well, several years ago, there was a proposition that the voters voted on that was going to change the tax structure, and there was a lot of promises made by industry. One was that we were going to get north of $1,000 gallons of oil in the line, and if we voted on this, we would see the protection and large dividends, and those two did not came to fruition. And I bring this up because today, north of 70% of the voters support the concept of Senate Bill 92, and if this bill was before the voters as the last vote was taken, I would assume that it would overwhelmingly pass. And I believe many Alaskans believe that it is true that there is not a level playing field. And I believe they have that opinion because of Article 8 of the Natural Resources Chapter 2, which is the general authority. And I might read that into the record for the members. This is the Constitution requirement. It says that the legislature shall provide for the utilization, development, and conservation of all natural resources belonging to the state for the maximum benefit of its people. And I think that is why the people of Alaska strongly support this provision. With that, do you have any closing comments? Senator Giesel, do you have closing comments? Well, you have a comment, Senator Cronk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, I try to look at everything in a broad picture, and I know, you know, we want maximum value for our resources. And when I look at the Prudhoe Bay Field and the people that are there, you could see that their investment in that field literally stopped. They were just kind of like, let's just watch this field dwindle down. And then you guys, you know, obviously come in. And so if Hillcorp wasn't on Prudhoe Bay, actually taking over pretty much all the production of it, where would it be on Prudhoe Bay? And I have to look at also, you know, we're pulling out oil out of the ground, but the maximum benefit of the resource also, I'm looking at these numbers of people that are employed in Alaska making, you know, big salaries. You know, that has to take an effect of what we're doing. It's like, so if Hillcorp doesn't come in and production drops, where's our employee count for a state of Alaska? Where are these people, you know, that live all over across the state with jobs? Do they have those jobs? So I guess I'm just going to share that, you know, observation is I don't believe Prudhoe Bay would be producing the oil that they have, and the number of thousands of jobs that are related to your specific business wouldn't be here also. So I think I just made that more of a comment. But where do you think Prudhoe Bay would be at this time if it was left up to those major corps? Because they obviously looked like they were just disinterested in their investment in Alaska.
Yeah, through the chair, I think that's right. You know, we can predict with, I would say, a high level of confidence where production from Prudhoe Bay and all the other fields would be at this point in time had the prior operator remained in control, and it would be roughly 80,000 barrels per day less. The state would have received $1.3 billion in revenues less over the last 5 years than it has actually received.
Thank you. Thank you. Any further comments, questions? With that, I'll go to Senator Giesel for her closing comments before we set this bill aside with the anticipation that it is going to leave this committee or come up for a vote for the committee in the very, very near future. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Kathy Giesel, Senator for Senate District E. Mr. Chairman, I want to reintroduce a statement made in the record back in 2020. This was February 26, 2020. The Senior Vice President of Hillcorp Alaska was before a Joint Resources Committee. The man's name was David Wilkins. Some of the members of this committee remember Mr. Wilkins. Mr. Wilkins was asked, as a private company, what is your position on paying corporate income tax? Wilkins' response was this: our standing in Alaska on our taxes is we pay all our bills, as we do with all our taxes. We don't necessarily have an opinion on corporate income tax. That's a policy decision that you make. We are an LLC, and as we are one of thousands in Alaska. If the bodies say there is a corporate income tax, of course we'll pay it. On the same token, as with any tax that comes out, we view that as a cost to the operation, and it goes to the fact that we could drill wells or add cost. That's our opinion on it. But we understand we will be a good corporate citizen to the state and pay our fair share. I just want to read that back into the record, Mr. Chairman. This was extracted from legislative record. Mr. Chairman, the Hillcorp company does business in seven other states producing oil. Mr. Soje accurately reflected what appears on their website as far as oil production in Alaska of 135,000 barrels a day. In New Mexico and Colorado, the San Juan Basin, they're producing 120,000 barrels a day. The state and local taxes paid to New Mexico, Colorado, San Juan Basin, is $191+ million a year. This is from their website. It's information that was given to you in your original packet. Under Alaska, that column that says state and local taxes paid, there are asterisks. The asterisks say $750 million a year in annual state and local economic development activity and investment. Mr. Chairman, I would agree with your member, Senator Cronk, that points out the number of jobs that are created through development on the North Slope. Mr. Chairman, this particular company has invested an amazing amount into our state. But, Mr. Chairman, they've also been extracting a lot from our state, and I believe not paying their fair share the way the C Corps do. So I also would remind you, Mr. Chairman, that when we say, what if you guys left, the you guys part of it is a company with a single private owner. It is possible that there are a few other minor owners of this. All of that information is confidential. But we know that Jeffrey Hildebrand is a billionaire in Texas who is paying taxes not only in New Mexico, Colorado, but Louisiana, Texas, Wyoming, Pennsylvania, and Ohio that amounts to significantly more than is being contributed, as you cite our Constitution, to the best benefit of the people of Alaska for this resource. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing the bill. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Members have questions? We will set this bill aside, and as I stated earlier, this bill will come before the committee in the very near future for our consideration. That brings us to the third item on our agenda today, that being Senate Bill 156, Alaska Commercial Fishing and Agricultural Bank Loans. This is the first hearing on this bill. I invite Senator Keel to introduce the bill. Senator Keel, please identify yourself for the record and explain to the committee what this bill does.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jesse Keel, and I have the privilege of serving Senate District B. With me is Ella Adkison of my office. Senate Bill 156 comes out of the legislative task force examining the future of the seafood industry, which I could never get my staff to stop calling Fish Force. So I may refer to it that way for short. Mr. Chairman, this bill is an outgrowth of a step we took last year because Alaska's commercial fishing businesses are in crisis. Financing has dried up in many places in many ways. Runs have diminished. Prices are down. International economics have been unusually challenging. So during the last legislative session, this time 1 year ago, the legislature took an unusual, short-term, time-limited step to help an industry out of crisis, something that is not and ought not to be our long-term approach to state lending. We lowered, for a three-year period, the interest rate cap from the state's commercial fisheries revolving loan fund, and we made it possible, in some circumstances, to borrow more for refinances. That had the intended effect, Mr. Chairman. It is saving Alaska fishing families significant amounts of money. It has saved several small Alaska fishing businesses. It has also had an unintended effect. The legislature created CFAB, the Commercial Fishing and Agriculture Bank, decades ago. It is created by statute, although it is not a state entity, and it serves a public purpose to help, among other things, the commercial fishing industry with its financing needs. Mr. Chairman, CFAB and the Revolving Loan Fund are the only two entities that can use a limited entry permit as collateral. That's what sets them apart from any other lender anywhere. But CFAB does not have access to general state financing and was unable to match the temporary low rates that we provided from the Commercial Fish Revolving Loan Fund. And so while their board was very supportive of the action we took because it helps the industry that they serve, it also may starve them to death as CFAB borrowers refinance out to go to the revolving loan fund and new loan volume has dried to a trickle or zero. Mr. Chairman, the recommendation of the task force was to provide short-term, limited duration help to CFAB to keep their doors open. Senate Bill 156 is the result of that recommendation. It is a very tight and limited approach. It is actually more limited than the task force's recommendation. It is, again, a temporary measure to get through a crisis. What Senate Bill 156 proposes is that the state use something very similar to the way CFAB was originally capitalized when it was created decades ago. A purchase of preferred non-voting shares of ownership and rules for CFAB to use that infusion of capital in ways that mirror what the revolving loan fund can do. This ability to use that capital will expire at the same time the temporary low rate for the revolving loan fund expires. So what you'll see in the bill, Mr. Chairman, is a requirement that this money be used to further CFAB's ability to issue or refinance commercial fishing loans, 15-year fixed terms capped at 5.25%, just as the revolving loan fund does. Mr. Chairman, that's not enough to replace all of the volume CFAB is going to lose. This is not a bill that will keep them fat and happy. It will keep the lights on. There are some safeguards built into the bill. At the end of the now 2-year period, CFAB will submit information to the state's Division of Banking and Securities, and if there is any money from that infusion of capital that wasn't used for these loans, I doubt there will be, but if, that will be owed back to the state general fund right away. The rest of that money will be due back at a time certain, 20 years from the date that the shares were purchased. Mr. Chairman, the goal here is just to keep this lending institution afloat through a short-term crisis and keep it available into the long term to finance Alaska's small fishing businesses. With that, I will commend the bill to the committee. I am happy to take questions. We also have the head of the Commercial Fishing Agriculture Bank available as invited testimony.
Questions for the prime sponsor, Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I see this is a cleanup bill over a solution that created more of a problem, I think. So why not just repeal last year's action?
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To answer Senator Stedman, there continues to be significant headwinds against the commercial fishing industry. While interest rates have come down from the tremendous highs they were at a year ago, they are still quite high. Prices have not fully recovered, and so there is continued interest from commercial fishermen in Alaska in refinancing existing loans, and there's still a need for boats and nets and permits, quota share, and all the other things that that financing can make possible as our small fishing businesses around the state try to weather this ongoing difficult time.
Senator Stedman.
Yes, and then the other question is last year when we were working on this amendment, I think it came in as an amendment, there was concern with the impact and support or lack of support from the commercial banking arena. So can you help us understand their position as you see it, the Alaska Bankers Association?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. To answer Senator Stedman, there is a letter we received in the last day or two from the bankers. They are very consistent in their philosophy about the state's involvement in commercial lending. The letter does not state direct opposition to this bill. Mr. Chairman, I agree. The state should not be in the business, generally speaking, of undercutting the private financial markets. This is a very limited, both in time and in scope, response to a crisis that is ongoing. This should not be our general practice, because we won't have banks if the state takes over the lending arena. What we're discussing in Senate Bill 156 is an infusion, I neglected to mention, an infusion of just a hair under $3.7 million that CFAB can use to stay afloat. We are not talking about a major or an ongoing shift in how the capital flows and private industry addresses these businesses.
Senator Stedden?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I can just quote from this letter, the last paragraph, it says, to address the adverse impacts of the state subsidized lending policies on commercial community banks, while maintaining support for the commercial fishing industry, the state should consider alternative approaches to foster partnerships between the state and banks. State-backed loan guarantees, co-lending arrangements, or interest rate buy-downs, et cetera, could be explored as options aimed at leveraging the strength of community banks. And so I'm a little concerned this may not be the best alternative to come up with a solution for the mishap we had last year that actually put the viability of the entity in question, financial viability in question, that now we have to do a bailout to keep them from going broke. So I'd like to have that looked into, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions? Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor, I can appreciate you're trying to solve a problem, but again, there's the competition with the private sector, but I'm just wondering, ADA, so their stated purpose is to provide financing for state businesses to aid economic development. Is there a structural reason why they wouldn't be engaged in this area of lending?
Mr. Chairman, to answer Senator Kaufman, I think that the key point of difference here really is the direct connection to Alaska businesses in the commercial fishing industry as reflected by the ability to use a limited entry permit as collateral. Nobody else can put a lien on a limited entry permit except the state's revolving loan fund and CFAB. So these are two ongoing entities that have operated for many years. The revolving loan fund really is capped at $400,000. And while perhaps when it was created, $400,000 could really get you started, it'll buy you a pretty old used wooden boat these days and not much else. And CFAB has the ability to lend larger amounts. I can't speak to the Industrial Development and Export Authority's ability to participate in loans to small fishing businesses. Certainly, they have a track record that includes some attempts to transform the processing industry, and that didn't go extraordinarily well.
Senator Kaufman?
No, thank you.
Further questions, Senator Stedman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look into this subject, I think we've got some testimony coming up here, but I would really like to understand from the Alaska Commercial Fishing and Agricultural Bank their financial position relative to a year ago, what their cash burn rate is, and as I recall this summer, there was concern at the Fisheries Task Force of their long-term viability could be extremely short-term, and I think we need to understand that. So we don't inadvertently make another error and create more problems, or the solution that we execute actually solves the problem.
Thank you. When Ms. Leshner gives her invited testimony, she could answer that question. Further comments, questions of this prime sponsor? Seeing none, we will go to invited testimony. We have Sharon Leshner, the CEO of CFAB. Please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and proceed with your invited testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman. My name is Sharon Leckner. I'm the president of Alaska Commercial Fishing and Agriculture Bank, more commonly known by the acronym of CFAB. CFAB was formed by the state in the 1970s with initial state funding in order to serve a public purpose. And more specifically, our statute says that we are restricted to lending to underserved industries such as fishing, timber, mining, agriculture, and now tourism. The state invested $32 million in Class C preferred stock, but that stock has been repurchased by CFAB, and CFAB is now 100% member-owned. The Commercial Revolving Loan Fund program of the 5.25% interest rate has been very important to the industry and almost all coastal Alaskan communities. We support the move to help the industry, but it has had unintended consequences for CFAB. A question was raised about what is our burn rate in loan payoffs, and what are our loan originations now that we have a very fierce competitor in the Commercial Revolving Loan Fund. Typically, in any year, our members repay their loans about $8 million per year, and that means we need to originate about $8 million per year just to stay even. In the last year, however, our loan originations have plummeted to about $1 million. And that includes the impact of a new loan program that we created to help people get working capital at a low interest rate rather than using their credit cards. That burn rate now is unsustainable for another 2 years. The purpose of the temporary infusion of capital would be allow CFAB to lend at 5.25% 15-year fixed also. It would help Alaska, because it would help expand the reach of last year's legislation by allowing up to 300 additional fishermen to also have access to low interest rate lending.
Thank you for that testimony. Do we have questions of Ms. Leshner? Senator Stedman.
Just for clarity, so when I'm hearing you say your burn rate, do you have about a two-year window where you go broke?
No, Mr. Co-Chair. We're not expected to go broke. We're very fortunate in that the annual report that each of you has received shows we have significant equity on our balance sheet. We wouldn't go broke, but we would no longer be able to cover our operating expenses because we would get too small, and we would need to somehow wind up our affairs. That's different than going broke. We have no expectation of going broke, but we do have the expectation that without relief, we will become too small to continue to operate as an independent lender to the fishing community.
Senator Stedman.
Well, not being a banker, you're going to help me about what wind down means and what position that would leave you in. I understand what going broke means, and you close your door and fire everybody. I understand that. But winding down means you're going to shrink the size of your organization to some substantially smaller size than you are today and try to survive with some other means, or I need some help on that.
Mr. Co-Chairman, we don't expect to go broke or go bankrupt, but we do expect that without the ability to maintain our size or grow, that CFAB would cease to be an entity that operates anymore. We would need to seek a way to dispose of our loans and return the capital that we currently have to our members. And then this lending entity would no longer exist.
Okay, Senator Stedman.
In layman's terms, that means you go broke and you liquidate your company. I mean, I don't want to be too fancy, but that's pretty plain. It's a going out of business sale. Am I understanding that correctly? That the day after, you know, the sign is no longer on your door?
So typically when a company goes broke, their creditors are not paid, and they walk away from their debts. That's not what we're saying. What we're saying instead is that we would need to seek a way to essentially sell our loans and use the cash to distribute it to the members that own the entity currently, our cooperative members, not going broke, but rather wrapping up our affairs.
Okay.
Senator Stedman.
Going out of business. You're out of business. I understand. Okay. So now I guess we got to come up with what we're going to do. And I'd like to ask the same question I asked the bill sponsor. Why not repeal last year's action?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that one option is to repeal last year's action. And if that happens, then the fishing community no longer has access to low interest rate financing. The alternative is to expand the reach of the bill and have more fishermen and more communities have access to low interest rate financing at a time when the industry is suffering economically.
Senator Stedman.
Okay, that's fine.
Further questions of the testifier? Seeing no further questions, we will go to public testimony. We'll open up public testimony, and we have in Ketchikan, the Alaska Bankers Association, Todd McManus. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can.
Hi, this is Todd McManus for the record. I'm president of First Bank in Ketchikan, and I'm a vice president of the Alaska Bankers Association. I want to thank you, Chairman, for inviting testimony on this bill. Just to be clear, you know, just our initial position, the Alaska Bankers Association, First Bank, you know, all of the bankers in Alaska support the commercial fishing industry, commercial fishermen. We do everything we can to provide lowest cost of financing available, and we provide loans and capital for the industry to help them grow and survive ups and downs. We do a lot of work with our fishermen customers to get through these times. We're also not opposed to CFAB, so opposing this bill, we don't have any, you know, axe to grind with CFAB as an industry or as an entity itself. As long as we're competing on a level playing field. So as you guys know, you've already discussed this bill as your direct result of action taken at the end of the last session that we also opposed, largely for this reason. We kind of foresaw that this would have downstream consequences on other lenders in the state. It didn't only impact CFAB's operations, it also took loans directly away from private banks in the state, and we also rely on those loans to, you know, earn income to pay our employees and support the communities that we're in through, you know, giving and all the things that we do at private banks do for the state. So it's a direct impact, not just on CFAB, but also the lending industry as a whole. To the co-chair's point about rescinding action, that would be the easiest solution as far as I can tell. Puts things back on a level playing field, allows for banks in the state to compete for those loans, even though we don't agree with that as a general policy of the those in the first place, but it at least put it even the playing field so that we have the opportunity for those loans. The other thing that happened with the increase in the dollar amount is where these loans used to be geared towards sort of smaller investments and maybe some smaller permanent lending, you're now capturing a large part of the fleet, at least in certain fisheries, with a $400,000 loan. You know, you could just about get any troller, gill netter in Southeast, and certainly some of the bay boats, except for maybe some of the largest seiners. You know, you're capturing a large part of the fleet now with that dollar amount. And I guess our position, as is stated in our letter, you know, if it's the goal of the state to support certain industries, as this program does, you know, we would be in favor of programs to partner with lending institutions that are already out there doing this business. So that would be, you know, maybe an interest rate subsidy similar to what the Bureau of Indian Affairs does for its loan guarantees, or a loan guarantee program, or just partnering with the banks to make these loans. If it's the goal of the state and the legislature to, you know, put money into the hands of fishermen, which is essentially what an interest rate subsidy is. So essentially, you know, we're opposed to the bill and its structure and the way that last year's action was taken. We're fully supportive of commercial fishing industry, and you know, we think CZAB should be able to compete on the same level playing field that we do. So, thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else online that wants to testify? Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing, and we'll go to Senator Stedman to review the fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the Department of Commerce, Community Economic Development, Community and Regional Affairs, OMB component 2879 at zero, Mr. Chairman. Well, there's another little number down here. Estimated capital cost, $3,693,000. Missed that little one. Good thing the bill sponsor's paying attention there.
Thank you.
The second one, the Department of Commerce, Community Economic Development, Banking and Securities, OMB component 2808. That is zero, I guess. That is the fiscal notes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Keel, do you have any closing comments before we set this bill aside?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing the bill today, and I look forward to working with the members so we can move it along.
Thank you, Senator Keel. That concludes the meeting today. We have a meeting scheduled this afternoon at 1:30. We will be hearing from the Office of Management and Budget on the latest union contract agreements. I might state that they have not confirmed that. There has been some media saying that we have much to do in this building from the third floor and do not want to be interrupted by members of the certain members, but in this case, the presence of the Office of Management and Budget to review the latest union contracts is most welcome and will not disrupt the work of the committee. So those were comments that the governor had made. So I anticipate that OMB is listening and will be here at 1:30. With that, we will, is there anything else to come before the committee? We are adjourned and we will reconvene at 1:30 to hopefully hear from OMB.